skipped over that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I'm just really grateful to have this conversation and just think it's so interesting going from when I learned about Juneteenth. It wasn't in school, as in undergrad, from other radical Black folk in our little living rooms just having a meal and talking, to now where this is a conversation at like the city and county level. So I think that I'm just taking a moment just personally to reflect on how progress feels, even though we have so much work to do. Just holding on to those things is the energy I need. So appreciate this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. And if people are interested in contacting you, is there any kind of way that they can do that?
Yes. Folks can absolutely reach me. My email is my first initial and last name, S. Clark, with an E at the end, at peace.net. I would love to connect and or, share.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You take care.
Good day.
Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the novelist and short story writer N.K. Jemisin, author of 8 previous novels, 2 short story collections, and a novella. John Scalzi calls Jemisin the most important speculative fiction writer of her generation, and Wired magazine calls her the finest writer of the fantastic of our time, and in light of Ursula K. Le Guin's recent passing, her worthiest successor. Jemisin's first novel, The 100,000 Kingdoms, the first book in the Inheritance trilogy, was shortlisted for the James Tiptree Jr. Award, nominated for the Nebula, the Hugo, and the World Fantasy Award, and winner of the Locus Award for Best First Novel. It was her second trilogy, however, the Broken Earth trilogy, that made history, where Jemisin became not only the first Black writer to win a Hugo Award for Best Novel, but also the first writer to win 3 Best Novel Hugos in a row, one for each of the Broken Earth trilogy books. The third book in the trilogy, The Stone Sky, also won the Nebula for Best Novel and the Locus Award for Best Fantasy. N.K. Jemisin's short fiction has been published in Clark's World, Tor, Popular Science, Idiomancer, and Abyss and Apex, and her latest story collection, How Long Till Black Future Month, won the American Library Association Alex Award in 2019. For 3 years, Jemisin also helmed and penned a science fiction column in the New York Times Book Review called Otherworldly, and she has recently been writing a new Green Lantern for DC Comics called Far Sector with Jamal Campbell. N.K. Jemisin is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her latest book, the first in a new trilogy of urban fantasy called The City We Became, published by Orbit Books. With starred reviews from both Booklist and Kirkus, Neil Gaiman says of The City We Became, "It's a glorious fantasy set in that most imaginary of cities, New York. It's inclusive in all the best ways and manages to contain both Borges and Lovecraft in its fabric, but the unique voice and viewpoint are Jemisin's alone." Rebecca Roanhorse adds, "The City We Became is a wonderfully inventive love letter to New York City that spans the multiverse. A big middle finger to Lovecraft with a lot of heart, creativity, smarts, and humor. A timely and audacious allegorical tale for our times. This book is all these things and more." Finally, NPR calls Jemisin's latest book a love letter, a celebration, and an expression of hope and belief that a city and its people can and will stand up to darkness, will stand up to fear, and will, when called to, stand up for each other. Welcome to Between the Covers, N.K. Jemisin.
Hi, thank you.
So The City We Became is the first book of yours set in our world, in the sense that it takes place in the contemporary United States, and more specifically in a New York City that in a lot of ways we recognize. But the book's story is organized around an idea that some might find fantastical and others not at all, that cities are particularly unique systems that, like an organism, they have life cycles and conditions in which they thrive, and they can also be killed. So can you orient us, before we do a deeper dive into the book, about this theory of cities from which the story emerges?
It's not even really a theory. It's just, you know, that part is reality. Cities obviously can be founded, obviously go through changes, periods of growth, peaks, periods of decline and decay, and frequently cities are destroyed by natural disasters or, you know, political upheavals and things of that nature. So, you know, they're like all systems in that systems emulate life, but then there's also the fact that life is itself a system of organization. You know, we've found that you put amino acids in the right kind of chaotic conditions and order emerges from that, or a form of organization emerges from that, and sometimes a form of entropy. And so that's just, you know, all I'm doing is really literalizing history in that sense. And the speculative element of it is simply that the cities talk and have a spokesperson or a spokesvoice, for lack of a better description, and you know, that an individual human being can embody some element of that city or that city's power. I think that's the only real speculative piece. Well, that plus, you know, vaguely Cthulhu-like monster from beyond. But yes. Yeah. And who's to say that's not real, too?
Right. Immediately, without orientation, we're dropped into an urgent situation in media res. Our protagonist, a poor, hungry, black, queer man, finds himself central to a battle that's somehow both supernatural and very familiar, to save a city. And he's called to be valuable, essentially, to a city that doesn't really value him. He navigates microaggression after microaggression in those first pages of the prologue, and finds himself in a battle with a monster that's very fittingly called Megacop. But the enemy of cities being born fully into their potentials as places, places that incorporate newness and difference, this enemy takes many forms, but most notably the form of what you call the woman in white. So I was hoping you could talk to us about the forces of the universe that amass against the birth of cities in general, and then dial down to talk about the woman in white and the way she personifies and sort of executes the will of this force.
Some of this I can't talk about because it's a trilogy, and there will be a lot more exploration of the nature of the woman in white and the origins and so on. I'll talk a lot more about that later. The woman in white is basically just, you know, representing the forces that are arrayed to destroy cities. In my experience and observation, those are homogenizing forces. Those are things that strip away the uniqueness and individuality and culture that becomes unique to cities. You know, we've seen it in New York in the sense of, you know, the New York accent is kind of fading away. There really isn't, you know, you've seen old movies where, you know, you've seen that very stereotypical Brooklyn accent and things like that. Excuse me. And that's kind of gone because a lot of the people that spoke it had to move away. They can't afford it here anymore. And the people who are coming in are coming in a lot of cases from the Midwest. So the accent is flattening. That's just a simple example. But the woman in white appears in various forms throughout the book, most frequently in she sort of takes over the body of an existing white woman who happens to be near the protagonist. She can use anyone with a certain kind of ideological inclination as a conduit for her will. I mean, she's not limited to white women. It's just that that's what we see. And she is also not limited in her form. We see throughout the course of the story that she has many bodies that she in a lot of ways is the same entity, even though we see multiple things attacking the protagonist throughout the story. But basically, and I've talked about this in other settings, in that the woman in white, in a lot of ways, is meant to personify the social justice concept encapsulation of whiteness. And whiteness being a created thing, a constructed thing. In Europe, there were many ethnic groups. They all tended to have white skin, but they certainly didn't think of each other as the same group of people. You know, ask any Irish person how they feel about being lumped in with British people, and you know, you're gonna get an interesting response depending on who you talk to. The French and the Germans never really particularly liked each other, you know, yada shmada. But in the United States and in other parts of the world that are kind of descended from colonialism, there was a concerted effort to push whiteness in lieu of the ethnic diversity that European immigrants actually kind of naturally brought. And the end result of it these days is a kind of flattening and homogenization. You know, I can't tell you how many of my white friends I've talked to who are like, you know, we don't have any culture. And I'm like, that's horse. But they're like, you know, I don't have any particular, you know, food culture. I don't have any particular, I don't speak the language of my ancestors who immigrated. I'm not sure what ethnicity my ancestors who immigrated possessed, and so on. I mean, that is just, that's the nature of how colonialism has manifested in the United States. You know, the way to make sure that there is common cause between the wealthy white upper classes that need to control the country and the masses of middle and lower class white people who need to help keep the brown people in line, is to kind of, you know, create this culture of sameness and homogeneity. And that is what we call whiteness. And it doesn't mean necessarily that all white people are bad. I mean, I've seen some interpretations of it that, you know, of the book or reviews of the book that kind of go there. But, you know, that's up to those folks and how they want to interpret it. But end of day, you know, whiteness in and of itself is harmful to those ethnic groups as well as it is to people of color, because of that flattening, because of that homogenization. And when you've got a city like New York, where you've got wave after wave of immigrants coming in, where you've got free black people and free Irish people forming villages and working together to try and kind of create new labor laws, or at least that's how it was in the 1800s until that kind of got purposefully broken up. You know, that's the kind of thing that I'm kind of addressing. This is what created the city. The diversity of New York is what makes New York as unique and interesting as it is. And as we see the current wave of gentrification coming in, gentrification is a flattening, homogenizing force. It is a force that consists, that takes lots of different forms, but frequently shows up in some of the forms that we see in the novel. Of there is a dynamic that we see a lot in New York City of white women coming into neighborhoods of people of color and calling the cops whenever they feel vaguely threatened. We saw an example of that just last week with the gentleman in Central Park who asked a white woman to put her dog on a leash, and she called the police and basically lied in front of him on camera and said, you know, that the guy was threatening her when he wasn't anywhere near her, was just asking her to put her dog on a leash. But she was perfectly willing to deploy a dangerous force that could have killed that man. Because she didn't want to obey the rules. And this is an example of, you know, kind of a pattern that we've seen again and again and again in American cities. And so that's basically what it is.
Well, it's interesting because I thought of that very incident in Central Park between Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper, who are not related, the black bird watcher and the white dog walker. Because the woman in white, she does animate people in New York to do similar things. There is literally a person who calls the police on people sitting in a park in New York, in the city we became. There's a foundation, the Better New York Foundation, which sounds like a benign or benevolent organization, but is actually behind a lot of the gentrification happening in New York that the woman in white is manifesting. But I don't think it would be a spoiler for us to say, since it happens in the opening pages, that this narrator, this representative of New York City, who discovers himself as an avatar for New York, something goes awry in his battle against Mega Cop, and the responsibility falls on the five people who are the unknowing avatars of the five boroughs to discover their calling and find each other. And this is based on a Japanese anime form called the Sentai. And I was hoping you could talk about the plot structure and the nod to this form as a way to organize the story.
Mostly it was just me trying to have some fun after the Broken Earth trilogy, which was one of the ways that I kind of expressed a lot of the stress that I was feeling over the Ferguson uprising. And here we go again. Basically, the it's not that something really goes wrong in the fight between the Avatar of New York and the enemy. It's just that New York is too big to encompass a single person. And the boroughs rise. The boroughs in New York, for those who are not familiar with New York, each borough of New York is a city in and of itself. Brooklyn alone is bigger than most American cities. Queens spatially is bigger than most American cities. Brooklyn in terms of population, Queens in terms of just sheer size. Even Staten Island is 500,000 people, which is bigger than the town that I partially grew up in. I grew up in New York City in Mobile, Alabama. A lot of people don't really understand that, like, when you've got a city this big, you've really got a collection of smaller cities. In some cases, cities that grew together, like Boston, just through sheer proximity. Or in some cases, it's just like each neighborhood of the city back in the days when New York was kind of being founded, because there is so much segregation and I don't even know what to call it, clannishness in a lot of the ways that New York has always operated. Each borough developed its own very, very unique culture. The individual people who become the avatars all have to work together because it's still one city, but, you know, end of day, New York is a bunch of squabbling, very angry people. So that seemed fitting. The whole Sentai thing just seemed like a fun way to kind of put it together. People who aren't familiar with Sentai, if you've ever heard of Power Rangers, you've heard of Sentai. So basically with Sentai shows, it means five-man team. You've got five people who have to come together. Frequently they wear color-coded clothing to kind of designate their vague personalities. Like the person in red is the leader and very hot-headed sometimes, and yada yada yada. The person in blue tends to be a little bit more cool, the planner, da 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 da. That was just me being silly. But they all have to come together despite their differences and fight as one in order to defeat the evil monster. So that was really it.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to N.K. Jemisin about her latest book, The City We Became. It feels like one of the lenses through which we can look at this book is as a book that both evokes and interrogates stereotypes and the violence that stereotypes can enact, both by commission and omission. It feels like you're doing both simultaneously, giving us something familiar like the Sentai form, which has a somewhat predictable way it unfolds as a narrative, but then when we least expect it, after you've lulled us into some sort of familiarity, pulling the rug out from under these expectations. And I wanted
to...
Are
we talking about spoilers in this podcast or no?
We probably... Well, maybe no.
Yeah, okay.
What do you think?
I mean, you know your readers better than I... Your listeners better than I
Let's not name the things that you've pulled near the end that you've pulled the rug out from under.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the question of stereotypes and the use of stereotypes around the questions of representation of New York City itself as a city. Because on the one hand, each of the five characters who are the avatars of the five boroughs, they do indeed represent characteristics and attitudes and stereotypes that we come to expect from those boroughs. But on the other hand, the five avatars of the city seem to be interrogating media representations of the cities. The five avatars are four women and one man, four people of color, indigenous, South Asian, black, and one white person. The avatars are not all citizens. The avatars are queer and straight. And these representations feel like a far cry from the typical things you'd see on TV, like Friends or Sex in the City. And so I guess I was hoping that you could talk about this balancing act of delivering what we expect and lulling us into perhaps the stereotype itself, and then flipping the script.
Well, what you're asking me here is, how do you write? So that's not really it's not really a thing I can articulate easily. Yeah. I will say that I was explicitly thinking about Friends and Seinfeld and all these other shows, and Girls, and just endless iterations of New York that don't look anything like the New York that I've lived my life in. And granted, I am a black woman. My experience of New York is probably going to be very different from that of Lena, whatever her name is, that made Girls. You know, so my experiences are obviously going to be different. But I mean, we aren't seeing those experiences represented on TV to the same degree. So I decided to write the New York that I know, and the New York that I know is overtly queer and overtly immigrant. And you know, there are, I like the percentage of different groups of people that you see in New York City is not represented in our television of New York City.
Right.
So I deliberately decided that I was going to go with those less shown, but equally valid and equally numerous representations and I guess proportions of New York City, and go from there. So, you know, it's not to a degree there were stereotypes involved. Obviously, like Island, Staten Island, is coming from a very conservative family. She is herself very conservative, very racist. And that's Staten Island. I mean, Staten Island is like the red state of New York City. And like, I mean that literally. It's the one borough that kind of consistently votes Republican. They've voted to secede from New York a few times and never managed to actually do it. And so, you know, this is, it's always been the kind of standout from the rest of the city in a lot of ways. And so I made Island literally stand out, in that she doesn't want to join the rest of the avatars. She doesn't want to be particularly part of the group, and so on. But that applies to nearly every chunk of New York in some way or another. Yeah. You know, the Bronx isn't particularly interested in being part of New York City either. Each of the boroughs of New York City are perfectly aware of the fact that they are cities in and of themselves, and that they can stand just fine on their own. You know, it kind of is necessity that forces them together. But on the other hand, when you mess with New York, you do get the whole city tending to respond to that, Staten Island included. And so that's really all I wanted to touch on.
Well, perhaps the biggest way you grapple with stereotypes and the violence of them is your overt engagement with the master of stereotype, H.P. Lovecraft, where you both use and invert his tropes. And I was hoping for listeners who aren't aware of Lovecraft, you could perhaps orient us to Lovecraft in the world of sci-fi fantasy and its history, and then maybe touch on Lovecraft's connection to New York specifically.
Anybody that's familiar with Lovecraft already knows this. So yeah, I in the book I talk explicitly about the fact that Lovecraft saw the energy of cities, saw the diversity of cities. It's clear from his writing, if you read any of his pieces about New York City, such as The Horror at Red Hook, that's a short story. Anybody can find it. It's probably free online in a lot of places. If you want to judge for yourself, go read that story and see how he depicted the people of Red Hook, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn that has had large numbers of immigrants over its history, large numbers of people of color, even to the present. Right now, it's kind of like best known for IKEA, but anyway. But so when you read Lovecraft, you see that he recognizes some metaphysical, quintessential energy in the diversity that cities produce, the languages, the foods, all of that. And his reaction is abject horror. His reaction is there's something horrible happening here that is a threat to white people that needs to be stopped. These people are somehow degenerate. They are not human like the rest of us. They are doing harm to us by their very existence and by their continued, being allowed to operate and function unimpeded. So all I basically did was also, I feel the same energy of cities. Most people who live in cities feel that energy. I think that energy is a good thing. And I just decided to write it as, well, what if the energy of cities that Lovecraft was terrified of was actually the thing that was keeping us safe from the stuff that he thought was great? So that was kind of it. Lovecraft, for those that don't really understand his context in science fiction and fantasy, he's considered the father of modern fantasy. I don't particularly agree with that interpretation, but there are a lot of people who are very invested in that idea, to the degree that the World Fantasy Awards for many years, until about maybe 2 or 3 years ago, their award statue was a bust of H.P. Lovecraft's head. And many authors complained about that, China Mieville most notably, and Nnedi Okorafor, who is a science fiction writer, Nigerian-American, won the award for her phenomenal Who Fears Death a few years ago. And when she won the award, she wrote an essay, which you can find online if you just Google Nnedi Okorafor and Lovecraft. But she wrote a powerful essay online talking about how it felt to win this award and this honor and then be given the head of a person who would despise her and despise everything that she's writing about and everything that she's trying to do. And as a result of the controversy that kind of came out of that objection, after years of back and forth and resistance, the World Fantasy Awards people changed the award statue. Now it's a lovely tree. But it took years of discussion, and during those years of discussion, you just saw science fiction writer after science fiction writer, and I use that as a lump term for all people in the genre, but you just saw writer after writer and personality after personality coming out and saying, well, sure, he was racist, but and there's just not a good ending to that damn sentence. And Lovecraft, even for a man of his time, for people who are like, oh, he was just a man of his time. No, people in his time were like, oh God, this man is like exceptionally racist. I've never really bought into the man of his time argument anyway, because in every time of American history, there's always been someone who was opposed to racism. There have always been anti-racists. Right. So that's a choice that people have made. Anyway. So that was basically where I was coming from with that.
And it's noteworthy, I think, that China Mieville, someone who uses who is very ensconced in weird fiction, which is associated with Lovecraft and uses a lot of tentacled cephalopod mm-hmm. creatures, was very opposed to the Lovecraftian legacy in the World Fantasy Awards, too, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, no one objects to acknowledging Lovecraft's impact on the genre. I mean, I acknowledge that impact as well. I mean, lots of people like writing about creepy tentacled old ones, entities, dark gods from beyond, whatever you want to call it. It's interesting material, but this isn't necessarily something that you want to treat as an honor. You know, you have to recognize the fact that Lovecraft's material came from his hatred and fear of the other, his hatred and fear specifically of his fellow human beings. He literally saw the people of Red Hook as monsters, as something subhuman that was calling to something even worse and threatening all reality. I mean, this is, you have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, as powerful as this imagery is, it's powerful because it's driven by fear and hatred. And that is something that we need to acknowledge in our society, that fear and hatred drive so much of it. Fear and hatred is the root of so much of American art. And, you know, sure, you can acknowledge that. You don't have to, like, be like, but that's a great thing.
Right.
And that's kind of what the head, making the bust, his head a bust. Oh, God, I'm tired. I haven't had enough coffee. But, you know, that's kind of what making him as a symbol of the award implies, is that, you know, that his fear, his hatred, his paranoia, was somehow a good thing, and is something that people who are performing well or doing good work in the genre should be honored to be recognized as a similar hate monger and frightened, paranoid person. That's terrifying to me. Why? Like, the idea that someone thought that was a good idea. Whew. Anyway, fortunately, they've changed it.
Well, when Daniel Jose Older was on the show, who was one of the people behind the petition to change the yep. World Fantasy Award statue, we mm-hmm. talked about Lovecraft also. He wrote this piece, 100 Years of Weird Fear, on H.P. Lovecraft's Literature of Genealogical Terror, and talks about...
I don't think I read that one. Hmm.
It's,
okay.